Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a spectacular show for you this evening. NFL legend and pilot Jimmy Graham is here. We are going to talk about his story, so many other things, some amazing hangar flying, I'll tell you. Buckle up for this one. It is going to be absolutely fantastic. Before we get started, just a few things. Well, Social Flight is booming right now. We have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations. So many cool things happening as we slide into fall. I've been seeing pumpkin drops get scheduled, pie-in fly-ins. There's just things happening everywhere. And our mission here at Social Flight is to support general aviation and get everyone flying as much as possible. We do that by giving you a mission, a place to go. That's all of these events, all of these destinations. We have added thousands of destinations with photos, reviews, crew cars, you name it, in addition to all of those events. And if you don't catch an event that's happening on Saturday in your local area, it's gone. And so that's why it's so important to get out there, check it out, and do more. In addition to that, we have our Fly to Win Challenge. And we just gave away, just today, a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset to our winner, Ryan Leeward from Louisville, Texas. He flies a 1947 Stinson 108, and he's going to get that amazing headset. And now it's time for us to give away another one. So we're going to be giving away another headset on December 1st, another Lightspeed Delta Zulu, amazing headset. And sure, all you need to do is to log into Social Flight on your mobile app, check in at any airport. You get points for everywhere you check in. If you even do it once during the prize period, you're entered to win. You do it multiple times, get on our leaderboard, you get additional entries in that prize. So be sure to check out all of that. And then a quick reminder, we are back next Tuesday, also on October 8th. I'm here with Brian Schiff on our show, Cockpit to Cowl. That's a pilot and mechanics view on safety and current events and all sorts of things happening. So great show. Check it out, cockpittocowl.com. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by, coincidentally, Lightspeed Aviation and the amazing Delta Zulu headset with canary carbon monoxide detection and hearing acuity customized audio. I'll tell you, we found a carbon monoxide leak in the Bonanza using this headset. We didn't know about it. As soon as we popped open heat for the first time of the season, it went off. We found out we had a problem. So be sure to check that out. Now, on to tonight's program. Jimmy Graham is a legend in the NFL, beginning with the New Orleans Saints in 2010. His career included playing for the Seattle Seahawks, the Green Bay Packers, Chicago Bears, before returning to the Saints in 2023. During his career, he made five trips to the Pro Bowl and became one of the most prolific tight ends that the game has ever known. What you may not know is that off the field, Jimmy is an extremely accomplished both fixed wing and rotor wing pilot whose approach to aviation is as disciplined as his approach to football. His flying takes him across the tree line in his Vietnam era Huey, UH-1 Huey, and onto remote lakes in his de Havilland Beaver on floats or skis, upside down in his Extra 330, and into the flight levels in his Turbo Commander. Most of all, though, Jimmy Graham is someone dedicated to helping others. Whether it is flying veterans in the Huey or working with kids as the chairman of EAA's Young Eagles program, Jimmy Graham is a force of good in a world of aviation and beyond. I am absolutely thrilled to have him with us here tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Jimmy Graham.
Hey, how are you doing? Jimmy,
how are you doing? Thank you so much for joining us here on the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Obviously, it's a big honor, you know, to talk to the aviation community a little bit about, you know, my journey.
It's an amazing journey. I want to get to the journey itself, but I've got this big grin on my face because I have to start with a little bit of current events. And what I mean by current events is you just landed. You're operating on like minimum sleep right now, getting back from this crazy race, the Gumball 3000. I'm going to show a picture of this. Can you please tell people what this is? Because even though this isn't aviation, this is awesome.
Yeah, it's a very special race put on by a special man. His name is Maximilian, and he's from the UK. And many years ago, he had this great idea to get a bunch of supercars together and race the streets of certain countries. So they've been doing that. This was the 25th anniversary, and as you can see, we started in Saigon and went all the way to Singapore in 6 days, 5 countries, 3,000 miles. And I brought a very interesting car. You know, most people had supercar or a hypercar, but I brought a luxury Rolls Royce, a 1971 Shadow that I cut in half, made into a flatbed dually with a 12 valve Cummins. So I was for sure the first ever in any of those countries, especially racing and something like that. It was a wild event for sure.
It's nuts. And I mean, what one of the things, explain to everyone here, because you were telling me at one point that one of the challenges people don't even think about is what it's like, you had to get the car there and then to like even race it or even have it go across country lines doesn't seem to be, country boundaries doesn't seem to be something normally done.
Yeah, I mean, logistically, it was a nightmare. We were originally supposed to start in Egypt, but obviously, there's some interesting things going there. That photo you just saw is at Angkor Wat, which is a holy site, temple. It's one of the wonders of the world. And, I was able to drive through the gates of that. And, the truck's pretty wide. So my friend Chase, he was on the back trying to make sure that I didn't rip the door off of this ancient site. But basically, it took 4 months for the car to get there, really. First, we missed the boat leaving because we were stopped at customs for various reasons, obviously. Just because it doesn't look like a Rolls-Royce Shadow. And when it showed up, they're trying to figure out, where the VIN numbers are, which some of those we took off. And so they're trying to figure all that out. Then we had to rent a plane for it. So that actually flew there, and it'll be on its way back in another plane back to Miami. And then starting in Saigon, so it's Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Malaysia, then Singapore. And in every one of those countries, like no one can really drive from Vietnam, into Cambodia or Thailand. You have to have a separate license for each and a separate license plate for each one of them. So it's just very difficult to do logistically, but the Gumball 3000, they make the impossible happen. And, there was 110 cars there. I think it was 230 drivers, and somehow we made it to the end, which we had a bunch of issues because in shipping it had some corrosion. Staying at the port for a while, yeah, there's me climbing in the engine bay of it, and it was also hotter than Miami. I mean, it was so humid there. So, but when it was shipped there, a bunch of the seals had just been corroded. There was a lot going on, so. First thing I did was we went to a market in Saigon. The hotel sent me there, and they told me to keep my wallet close and my phone close, and I was probably going to play double. We walked through these little doors, and there's just corridors of parts and tools. I mean, it was a wild scene in there. I've never experienced a market like that before, and so we got tools, and we surely needed them. I mean, we had various leaks from the from all the seals, and then. One of my stabilizer tie rod arms snapped when we got to Thailand because we hit something going 100. And a lot of people had problems in Thailand because of the roads. And so I borrowed a bolt off a van. I cross-threaded it because it was in metric compared to the nut that I had. And then that got me another hour and a half to a shop in Bangkok. And then we had a big radiator hose exploded on us in Malaysia. And it was beautiful because the people in those countries are unbelievable. They are incredible people who will give you the shirt off their back, literally. And I remember the first time, because we had to continue to patch the radiator hose, a guy rolled up from his house with no shoes, no shirt on, in the dirt. And basically I was trying to translate and figure out how we could maybe wrap this or figure it out. And he gave me an old bike tire. So I wrapped that around, used some clamps, That got me an hour. Some more leaks started through the crevices of that, and we just kept adding. You know, some guy gave me a tie rod strap. He gave me like tie down straps. So I cut those up and put those to stop leaks. And so we did that for about 10 hours, showed up at the hotel at 2:30 and was back up at 6 to work on the car and get to the next. And that's what it ended up being after I cut it off. But on the other side of that metal clamp, all of that stuff had melted and sealed every crack that we had. So we actually finished the race on that, you know, half repaired kind of radiator hose. And, you know, we ended up winning Spirit of Gumball, which is their big award, which is, you know, obviously incredible. Came with a ring, a big trophy. Your name's on the trophy forever. And it was the wildest event I've ever been to. You know, unbelievable people, unbelievable countries. We ended at the Singapore F1 race. We took a boat from the hotel and was at the center grid. You know, it's just a crazy. Even Cambodia. I mean, Cambodia declared it a national holiday for us, so the roads would be clear. And then the prime minister, he threw us a gala for a foundation at the base of Angkor Wat, one of the wonders of the world. So I've had the craziest 2 weeks of my life, and certainly pretty tired.
I love that. And this to me is the photo that kind of sums it all up. This is wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, it was incredible. You know, every city that we showed up to, the grid had 500,000 people show up to see these cars. Most of these countries don't allow left driving cars in general. Like, it's illegal to drive those cars there. And there were so many kids lining the streets, and we had so many kids jumping on our, because, you know, we had the only one you could actually jump on. You know, like, I remember at a gas station, I'm filling up, because, so if you look behind her, there's a big tank there. Uh-huh. So 2 weeks before we shipped it out, because I was going to bring something else we have. I have a couple off-road Porsches. And so instead, we decided to do this crazy thing. So that's actually a fuel tank. So I added that fuel tank. It's 250 gallons of diesel. And there's a transfer switch from inside. I routed off of the battery, me and my boy. So I was filling up my fuel tank. And so we never had to stop at a gas station. It was pretty cool.
That's awesome. I absolutely love that. And again, I'm grateful you're able to come and share this story with us, because I know how rough you feel. Would you say 3 hours of sleep or something like that per night?
Yeah, it was 3 hours a night, because every night there's some crazy event that we have. You know, guys were up to pretty late, but I was working on the car so much. So I missed everything. Basically, I was just underneath the car. I was on my back, in the dirt in every country we went in. It was incredible. Just the people there were just unbelievable. The food, you know, Thai food's unbelievable. But I am exhausted. And then the flight change or the time change. So it was 12-hour time change, or 11 hours, depending on where we were. Plus, it took 24 hours of flying to get back. There was a 9-hour flight, and then there was a 16-hour flight, I think it was. Or 15. Wow. Yeah, it was brutal. So I'm pretty tired.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the things, I want to go back a little bit in your life to tell your story. And one of the reasons I want to do this is because I find your personal story of accomplishment is so touching and also so inspiring. And I think that matters for people to hear, right? Because so many people either know someone that they could be helping that could, along the way or along their journey, or themselves are going through some struggles in their life and trying to get on track. And in our aviation community, even, tell me a little bit about kind of how you got started, and then when you started to see that acceleration through college and the NFL.
Yeah. You know, my story, obviously, you know, has been told a few times, a little bit of it. You know, I keep all the really bad stuff to myself, but, you know, this tracks back to, you know, when my father left, and then my stepfather dropped me off on the side of the road when I was, I believe, 10. And then my mother, a year later, she dropped me off at a facility. I was there for a year and a half. Came back home, and then I believe I was 15 when I left my house. You know, I was taken in by a lady, her name was Becky. And, you know, she was very instrumental on, you know, many things. You know, first, you know, being one of the first people to ever tell me she loved me. And one of the biggest things was she was the first person ever told me I was smart. I had never experienced that. At the time I'm 15 years old. And, you know, when someone gives you that kind of light and tells you, oh, by the way, you're really smart. I don't know why you're, you know, not doing this and that. Then you start to believe it and you start to try harder. So, you know, whenever I graduated from my high school, you know, I ended up being valedictorian somehow and went off to college, went to the University of Miami on a basketball scholarship. So I played 4 years of college basketball and had some NBA tryouts, had some stuff overseas. And then all of a sudden, because the president of University of Miami, she loved me. She honored me at graduation for kind of all that I'd been through. And she had a lot of talks with our head coach at the time. And so they came to me and offered me a scholarship to come back and play football. I had some big decisions to make. So really for me, you know, obviously it was hard to give up money overseas. It's hard not to go to NBA tryouts. I really remember all the people who laughed at me whenever I told them I was thinking about playing football. A ton of people, you know, a ton of people that really shouldn't have been laughing, you know, that were coaches of mine and colleagues of mine. And everybody thought it was funny. And I remember a guy told me, and he's supposed to be a leader for me. He told me, one, he said, Jimmy, can you even catch? And which was a weird statement because I played basketball. And then he told me, grown men play that sport. That's a sport for grown men. So, you know, after he said that, I knew I had to try it. And 6 months later, you know, I ended up being drafted by the New Orleans Saints. So that was wild. You know, my first, I mean, really, I learned how to play football in the NFL. I remember being invited to the combine, going to the combine, because I didn't really know the rules of football yet. I mean, I didn't know much about football. So I had a coach at the time who was teaching me the basics of defense and offense. And I remember being up in my room and I put it on like big painter, like this big like painter thing, like usually people use the paint. And I had all these plays drawn up and all these things memorized. I didn't know them at all. I just was like, every one of these interviews, this is all I can say. Ended up doing well, dominated that, and placed high on pretty much everything. And then my pro day, I had a really good day. So ended up being drafted third round. And then I'm sitting there not knowing the rules of football. And I'm in the huddle all of a sudden with the Super Bowl champions, with Drew Brees, Reggie Bush, Marcus Colston, Jeremy Shockey, and Lance Moore. And one of the best at the time and still O-lines to ever live. So I had to learn very quickly.
Wow. That's fascinating to me. And take me a little bit back into the mind of the 15-year-old that someone reached out to and that Becky reached out to and was willing to believe in. We're always trying to do outreach, especially in aviation. So many people feel that aviation is so unattainable, such a completely different world. And yet we need people. We need mechanics. We need pilots. We need people desperately and want them. What was your reception when you had someone reach into your life? Was it natural or was it difficult? Or what advice do you have for people looking to be those kind of Beckys of the world?
The one thing that, I mean, I knew Becky before, she was doing this thing called House Church, and I went there for the free food and the girls, and she found she found out a little bit more about my home life a little bit later. And she went through some very similar things in a way. You know, she was homeless at the age of 16. She had been through a lot. And so she really understood where I was. You know, she understood a kid that, you know, was kind of, angry, I guess, at the world. But she also understood and knew that I also was trying to find a better path for myself. You know, I remember whenever I got out of that home, one of the things that, one of the conversations I had with my mother, because she would never listen to the things that happened to me. I told her, I said, listen, what's sad is that I'm already smarter than you, but you have control over my life. And I told her when I turn 18, that I'll be nothing like you. And so, you know, I already had kind of that mindset in me to, you know, break down every barrier that was put in front of me. So I was very driven and it just takes sometimes just one person. And you know, it takes one person to tell you something. It takes one person to help you and genuinely mean it and not want anything in return. And so, you know, she was really the first person, or one of the first people I ever met that really, you know, really cared to help me and didn't want anything in return. Never thought that there would be anything on the back end. You know, she just did it out of the kindness of her heart. And, you know, I think a lot of adults don't realize, you know, a lot of kids, especially when you've gone through a very tough childhood, especially as young as I was, you're not an idiot. You know, you've been able to see a lot already in life, you know, more than most adults, and you've probably listened to a lot of conversations you probably shouldn't have been listening to. And so, you know, you kind of have an older soul about you, and you know, you just have to be real with the kid, you know, and really truly find out, you know, what makes them tick, you know, find out what they're into, you know, find out, you know, have meaningful conversations, you know, not just surface level stuff, because every conversation you have, and the more comfortable that the kid gets with you, you know, he or she is going to continue to open up about what's really going on, you know, what's going on with their home life, what's going on, you know, kind of in their brain. And, you know, that's how you can really start change, is really by just being completely honest and truly wanting to know more about them, how they feel about things and the things that they've been through. You know, it's a slow process at times, but you know, it could truly change a life, and surely it did for me.
That's so powerful. And the other thing about your personal story, I think that's really fascinating and inspiring, is that you, when you had these opportunities show up, a lot of people get opportunities in their lives and they tend to pause and doubt themselves when they're in those situations. And you, what was it that helped you push forward, that helped you be in a locker room where you didn't know all the rules, that helped you push into all these situations, even though it might be something that people would have to face a lot of self-doubt?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of, you know, kids in general that come from adverse backgrounds, or, you know, come from a certain socioeconomic status, some of the biggest things is just opportunity. You know, I lacked a few opportunities growing up, and I was the type that, you know, I knew there was no backup. You know, I mean, I knew there was nobody that would help me. I mean, I knew there was no other opportunities. You know, I remember when I decided to play football, I mean, I literally told myself, hey, this is your last chance to make good on your athleticism. You know, I knew I was athletic. You know, I knew that I was a hard worker. I knew I was tough, but you know, I fell short in basketball at the time, I felt, and it, you know, it was my chance to continue to show that, you know, the athlete that I was, the person that I was. And so for me, I think what really helped me, you know, is there are a ton of kids that have options, right? You know, you have a ton of options when it comes to sports. You know, you have a ton of options when it comes to school. You know, I didn't have in those things, so every opportunity I had, you know, this was it. You know, I mean, that's why even when I went to college, you know, there was, you know, if anything happened or if I was ready, I would just move myself away from it. And, you know, I said, you know, I can't be around this, or I can't be around you. You know, I cannot mess up. I do not have more opportunities. You know, the only thing, like, I remember, like, when I give the Huey tour here in Miami, it's incredible because I fly by the University of Miami. And, you know, and it's really the beginning of the tour. And I always tell people, you know, I showed up here 20 years ago, and when I showed up, I had a book bag and a pair of sheets from Target. I didn't have a blanket because I thought that they would give you a blanket. So for my first like 3 months in college, I just slept with a sheet over me. And you know, that's all I had to my name, literally. You know, I mean, I had nobody besides Becky, and I had no one. And so that's how I faced everything. You know, I faced everything as if, you know, like the big famous saying is, you know, you have to want it as bad as you want to breathe. And you know, I certainly did. And many, many things I did in my life, I, you know, I put myself to the edge, you know, to the, you know, most people, they're afraid to jump, right? Because they don't believe they can fly, you know, you know, I was the type that when I got to that edge, I would just jump and see what happened. And for me, it was enough to just try it. you know, even football, you know, I even told myself, you know, to be a dual athlete nowadays is so rare, and to play for the University of Miami football team, you know, which I loved growing up. I think everybody, you know, has, oh, you know, you think of those 2000, 2001 team, 2002 teams, you know, you remember the jerseys and, you know, the swag that they came with. And so to go and, you know, for me to run through the smoke, run through that tunnel, that was enough accomplishment. And whatever came after that was just icing on the cake. So, you know, for me, I was good enough with it, just pleasing myself and satisfying myself. You know, I think in most of the things that I've done in my life, there was no external motivation besides me. You know, there was no external motivation like, oh, I want to impress this person. Oh, I want to make this person happy, like a parent or something, that I'm doing this, like going to law school or something. You know, for me, I just chased my dreams. And that was just enough for me. You know, I always just said, you know, if I just continue to chase my dreams like I've been doing, you know, I'll find happiness. And you know, it definitely led me to it.
Wow. And, you know, one of the other things that strikes me is you have this opportunity with this raw talent, and also obviously you're brilliant, extremely smart, and able to see all this. But you were able to get put into the situation, especially starting in the NFL, where you were around elite talent in so many ways, whether it be the physical skill or the mental skill or the diligence in the way that people worked or just their personalities. Tell me a little bit about that experience of being in that group of people and what you can learn from in that environment.
Yeah, you know, I do think that a lot of people, I mean, especially when you get out of college and you get into the workforce, can be intimidated, you know, can be intimidated about, you know, the office and the, you know, executives or your boss or your boss's boss, right? Or even a colleague, you know, like your colleague went to Harvard Law and, you know, has all these accolades. You know, for me, you know, I always saw that as such an advantage, as somebody who doesn't understand anything or is just so young in it. You know, I see it as like, what a great opportunity to learn from the best. You know, I'm not going to have bad habits because I'm learning from the best ever do it. And, you know, that's been in football and in aviation. You know, I've had incredible instructors that people have done, you know, and had insane careers in aviation. And I was lucky enough to learn from them. And that's why I think I can fly and do so much with an aircraft. And it was equal with football, you know, to be able to learn from Drew Brees and for him to take me under his wing, you know, that's priceless. You know, I had Jeremy Shockey, David Thomas, you know, I learned from Lance Moore and Marcus Colson how to run routes. You know, Zach Strees tried his best to teach me how to block, but I didn't learn that until I got to Seattle. And you know, it's that is super important. And I would say it also relates to everything in life. You know, who you surround yourself with is where you're going to end up. So you know, and it doesn't matter what it is, if it's in sports, if it's in life, you know, who you are around and the friends that you carry, you know, that's going to be your ceiling is that, you know. And I was unfortunate enough to be around, you know, the Super Bowl champions and one of the best coaches that ever lived. So it was an incredible place to be.
Yeah, that is, I'll tell you, it's one of the things that has always struck me about you is that ability to absorb all of that knowledge and talent and skill from so many different people that you're around and continue to build yourself up and develop yourself. And do you think that the fact you were able to play in these different environments for these different teams added to that helped you get all this diversity? Because you do the same thing in aviation in a way, which we'll get to in a minute, but it started, it seems like, in the NFL moving around.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had no choice at that point. You know, I had sued the NFL. So when you do that, you know, my head coach at the time, he testified against me. So our relationship was kind of not great at the time. You know, especially since he was the highest paid coach to ever live at the time. And you know, I just wanted a contract. But you know, I was franchised, and the franchise tag at the time wasn't built for the tight end position currently that existed. You know, me and Gronk came into the NFL and we started, you know, leading our team in catches, yards, and touchdowns. And we, you know, that kind of wasn't normal. You know, Gates did it, Gonzalez did it, back in the day, Shannon Sharp, you know, a couple guys had done it. Kellen and his father, but it wasn't, you know, normal to catch 99 and to score 16 touchdowns. So when you franchise, most of those guys were blockers and we were just receivers. So, well, at least I was. And so, you know, you want a contract, especially the way I played was so violent. And I played with kind of a reckless abandonment. You know, I mean, I love New Orleans so much. You know, what that city did for me and you know, all the love that city showed me. You know, every time I went out there on Sundays, I mean, even last year when I got the opportunities, you know, I remember almost every third down a red zone cut I would do, I was willing to blow my knee out. You know, I would cut with everything I had. You know, everything I did to the absolute max for that team. And so, you know, I had to kind of protect myself because I knew, you know, it was a matter of time before I had a major injury just because of the way I played and, you know, it was working. So why change? So,
yeah. So tell me about how you then transitioned into aviation. Where did aviation enter your life?
That was, I always wanted to be a pilot since I was a kid. Whenever I went into high school, I still had dreams to be a fighter pilot and join the military. I was from a military family, so, you know, had deep connections to the military, grew up a little bit. I was born in Fort Riley, lived in Germany on a base, and then was on Fort Bragg for quite a while. And, you know, I grew up around a lot of tier one operators and, you know, understood what that life was about, you know, understood what that decision was about. You know, that's why the most respect for the military is because, you know, you choose that life and you chose this. And I have absolute respect for anybody that does that. And so, you know, unfortunately, when I got to high school, I started growing. So once I passed about 6'4", I knew, you know, being a fighter pilot was out of the window and, you know, I would probably be scrubbing floors. So that's when, after I got drafted, after your rookie year is the first time you have money and time for most of us. You know, none of us ever had a dime to our name. And we most likely, all of us, to get to that level, have been working out in some sport since we were 14 or even earlier. You know, I had been working out constantly, had never had time off. So you have this chunk of time before, after the season's over till the off season starts. Most guys, they, you know, they travel, they party, you know, they do a lot, you know, spend a lot of money. And for me, I still didn't know the game. And I also didn't feel like I earned anything, you know, like most guys are like, oh, I'm in the NFL. Let me live an NFL life. You know, like my workouts were, you know, Jonathan Vilma, Reggie Wayne, you know, Frank Gore, Ed Reed. I mean, it was all pro players and they would go out Fridays or Saturdays. And, you know, I remember the first time I got invited and, you know, first thing I told Vilma is, you know, man, I feel like I just haven't earned it yet. You know, I haven't earned it to be there with you guys and to be doing that. You know, I have, like, I can't rest on laurels if I have none. So what I did was I went to flight school. And I went to flight school every year for the first 10 years of my career. And I did it, one, was to exercise my mind. Two, it was to, you know, constantly make sure that in the off season that I was on a task and just really improving myself, right? Because I mean, I come from such a weird background, you know, missing school at times. There's a lot that I had to learn. You know, and I knew where I wanted to get in life, that I needed to be disciplined. I needed to, you know, try new things. And aviation was the perfect outlet for it. So, you know, I got, you know, basically 10 different licenses in the first 10 years of my career. And, you know, it really helped me in many ways, just from the discipline alone. I mean, you know, who wants to play 7 months straight, have a surgery maybe, and then, you know, a week later you're in flight school. With a knee brace, you know, I mean, I did that multiple times and it just kept me on task, kept me focused on flying and working out in football.
Was there a mission of something you wanted to do that you were thinking like, this is how aviation would fit in my life if I had the ticket? Were there some?
Yeah, that might be coming up one day. But so the first aircraft that I was ever in, a small aircraft, was an extra 300. So I got lucky. You know, and he took me up and we were upside down over one of the keys. And, you know, I told him that day, I'm going to do whatever it takes to do this one day. And so when I first got in, it was always to eventually get into air shows. You know, I mean, I had grown up around a lot of air shows from living on military bases. So, you know, I'd been to so many of them, you know, even because my stepfather was he was 82nd Airborne, and then he was a Green Beret. So I saw him jump out of planes during air shows, you know, so I always thought that, you know, one day I'd love to do that. And I also understood that football was very finite. You know, the average career in the NFL is 3 years. And so my time in this isn't going to be long, and I wanted something for after it, you know, I was passionate about and that I loved. And, you know, aviation for me was that. And so I started that journey a long time ago.
I didn't realize that I mean, I've always, you know, known that you fly the 330, you do aerobatic stuff, but I didn't realize you wanted to be on the air show circuit.
Yeah,
I know we're both friends with Rob Holland. I know that you watched me did, but I didn't realize it was that's where you wanted to be.
Oh yeah. And you know, that's why, you know, we've had many, many conversations, you know, talking right now with the Jet Walko. You know, he's he's an incredible guy, and you know, he's doing that show now. And, you know, I might pair with him for some photo flights, and then in the future, you know, thinking about, you know, maybe finding a sponsor and building a Walko 2.0 that's on another level, and, you know, maybe flying that in kind of a formation deal. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are kind of on the list. You know, obviously I do the Huey in quite a bit. We'll do random air shows, we'll come in for static, but, you know, to do it in front of a crowd, I think that is, for me, really going to fill the gap from the NFL. You know, I can't even express what it's like to be, you know, in the Superdome, to be in Seattle, to play for these teams, and to be one-on-one on the outside, and everybody knows where the ball's going, and that ball goes in the air, and you catch it, and you've got 75,000 people going insane. It's addicting. You know, I mean, it's addicting winning. It's addicting winning that way, especially when you can be a game changer like that. So, you know, for me, that adrenaline rush and that love for a crowd, that love to entertain, you know, I think the only way to fill that gap is to flip planes in front of people.
That's awesome. And I love that you're taking this angle of the Jet Walko, because your aviation experience is so diverse.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling to me. So you mentioned, like, you know, all these different tickets, every season you go back, get another ticket. Tell me a little bit about that progression and that process, because as I mentioned at the show openings, for folks who don't already know, you are, and you mentioned the Huey already, your rotor wing, your off airport, your seaplane, you name it. You do all these things. Help me understand how you got there, where your heart is, and all these different things.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, one, just absolute hats off to everybody I ran into and all my instructors. You know, I can't tell you, you know, the stories and the conversations and the teachings that I got over, you know, over a 14-year period, you know, has been just life-changing in many ways, not only in aviation, just life in general. But I originally started, like most people, you know, I learned in a 172, 114 Foxtrot Bravo, I'll never forget it. And it was the Tamiami Airport. And you know, I remember the first time taking off on my solo, I think I was at 11 hours. I was actually taught by a guy named Wesley Johnson. He's Jamaican, and, you know, he's got a deep accent. And he came up to me and he's like, "All right, well, today's the day." And I'm just looking around like, "What do you mean?" You know, he's like, "Oh, you're going to solo." I'm like, "No, I'm not." You know, I mean, at the time too, a lot of people didn't know. I mean, I kept the aviation stuff quiet for about 3 or 4 years. I didn't want anybody to find out, because it technically wasn't in our contracts yet. But I knew that was going to be a problem for me in the future. And I knew if I wasn't a certain level of player that they would take that away from me. So for the first 3 years, I never told anybody. I mean, nobody, I owned two planes before I even had Instagram, because I was late to Instagram. I didn't want any, like, I had no social anything. I didn't want anybody to see what I was doing. So after I got my private, then I went out, and the idea was, most people's like, don't get a Bonanza, you know, don't do that. That's too much of a plane for you, blah, blah, blah. But for me, my aspect of it is, well, one, I'm gonna learn with amazing people. I'm gonna have someone in the right seat for however many hours. And why wouldn't I learn my IFR in the platform that I know I'm gonna carry and build time in? So I ended up getting a G1000, a G36. And, you know, I flew that around for quite a while until I got traded. And in between that, there's a guy, his name was Corey Wallace. I called him up, he's a good friend. I called him up, I cold called every school that had Tailwheel endorsements, trying to figure out where I could get a Tailwheel endorsement. And so he picks up the phone and, you know, I just, you know, ask him if they're giving Tailwheel this and that. And at the time they had a Cub, they had an S2B Pitts, and they had this thing called the Extreme Air, which Steinbach now, he's the one building the Game Birds. So he was also building the Extreme Air at the time in Germany. So it was the perfect fit. So I used to fly the Bonanza up to Palm Beach to get my Tailwheel endorsement. And then I started flying the Bonanza back up to get aerobatics. I learned an S2B. I could only be in the plane for 20 minutes or something before my back would seize up because of the angle of that seat. You know, I'm just too big to be in a Pitts.
I can't imagine you in a Cub, man. What are, you're 6'7", 265?
Yeah. Well, I also called him, and right when I ended that call, I told him, I said, the only problem is I'm kind of big. And, you know, he's like, well, how big? And I was like, well, I'm 6'7", 265. Or at the time, I'd have been 270. I might have told him 260. But so I took my shoes off. I mean, I couldn't fly with shoes on. I had to be barefoot. There's a bunch of stuff going on. But what an incredible plane to learn in, especially Tailwheel. You know, I can't say enough about how people who are serious about aviation, serious about safety, serious about their piloting skills, to go get a Tailwheel endorsement. You know, you're going to get in a Cub. You're going to be doing single wheel landings, left, right, left, right, left, right, all the way down the runway. Some of the most fun you've ever had. And if you've got a good wind, you know, you're going to be flying backwards in the downwind. It's you know, to start on one side and end up at the other side is wild, especially when you have the engine on going straight. So, you know, what I learned from that and what I learned from him, he also, like most of the people that have taught me how to fly, they're all AMP mechanics as well. So that's when we really got to dive in, and I got my first real lessons really in airplane systems. And, you know, I think that's why, for me, it's a lot easier, you know, to you know, because in one day I'll fly, you know, the Huey, the Extra, the Beaver, the Commander. And I mean, sometimes I have flown all four before a few times. So when you're doing that, you know, that's why I have a hat for everything. Like, this is the Huey hat. My uncle told me, he said, you know, it's like every time you get in an aircraft, you need to put on that hat. So I physically put on that hat now and always have, because you are a different pilot now. You know, everything, yes, some of the stuff is like the basics are the same, right? You're going to listen to ATIS, weather's the same, airports are the same. Well, not for helicopter or seaplane, but it's all base stuff. But operating that aircraft is completely different, and it takes a completely different skill set. It takes a completely different mindset. And so I was blessed enough. Most of the guys that taught me were all mechanics. So we didn't just go over the base level of things. You know, Corey brought me to a prop shop he used to own. You know, that's how I learned all there is to know about a prop, how it operates, how those systems operate. And then even planes I wasn't flying, you know, to be able to see how turbine props and how that all actuates was, you know, was just knowledge that, you know, I implore everyone who's in aviation to, you know, to definitely spend some more time on the mechanics of it, you know, because, you know, that's gonna help you catch things. You know, if you hear something, smell something, you're gonna know exactly what it is because you have such a base knowledge, which is, you know, been amazing for now, you know, that I'm living on a sailboat, you know, that's, I have to fix everything on that. So you know, it helps with everything in life.
Man, is there anything you don't do? I didn't. You're like, yeah. Now that I'm living on the sailboat and fixing everything.
Yeah, I've got a lot going on for sure.
So, at what point did you go to, you did the Tailwheel, you've done the aerobatics. At what point did you decide that rotorcraft was next, that you're going to fly helicopters?
Yeah, so after I got the after I got the tailwheel and started doing aerobatics, I also that a lot of people don't realize, but my extra has like three invasion stripes, the red stripes. That's those red stripes really are for Adidas. Technically, Adidas bought that plane because the first 8 years of my career, no, 9 years of my career, I didn't spend a dime of my contract money. I only spent my endorsement money. So based on the endorsements I would get is why I ended up having these planes. So the extra, literally those three stripes are because of Adidas. And that was a, I was last year was my last year with them. I was the longest tenured Adidas NFL player in the league. I'd been with them since I first started. So, they'd always been loyal, always been great to me. So, I had to do that. And I remember I bought that, and that was actually made in Germany. So that's an extra 330LX when they first came out. It's an absolute rocket ship, just an unbelievable aerobatic aircraft. And Doug Veda, he sold me that. And I remember Doug, he's like, "Hey, make sure you're getting tailwheel, make sure you're getting aerobatic experience." Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, "Oh, I know, I've gotten find S2B." So I show up, and Doug sends me through this, this whole course teaching me all kinds of stuff, and then from there he's like, "All right, I think you're good. Enjoy." He's like, "You're gonna figure it out on your own, and just follow the manuals. Don't do anything stupid." And so I hopped in, put on the parachute, and flew to New Orleans, and it was there all during the season. So every off day I'd go up and do aerobatics, and that take people up, and it was a good time for sure. And then so basically after that, so the rotorcraft wasn't till after the seaplane as well. So then after that, I ended up getting traded to Seattle. Seattle is one of the most unbelievable aviation cities you could ever live in. It was an absolute blessing to be able to be there and to be able to meet the pilots and engineers and mechanics that live up there. Obviously they that's where Boeing is. That's where a ton of tech is, and that's where the grassroots of a lot of aviation comes from. Is Seattle. It's from Clay Lacy to Joe Clark. It's just it's wild how many of those guys all grew up together. So I'm there my first week on the job. This old man comes in and he walks up to me and he says, "Hey, I hear you're a pilot." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, are you a seaplane pilot?" And I was like, "No, I've been waiting to go to Jack Brown. I just haven't had time." And he said, "Well, I flew in. Let's go fly." So he had a Beaver. And it was John Nordstrom. So John Nordstrom, he used to own the team, and he sold it to his good friend Paul Allen. And so I went up in the seaplane, and then the next weekend I got my seaplane endorsement. And then he's the one who also helped me to rebuild mine. I bought a wreckage out of Canada that was in a junkyard somewhere. There it goes. And so I saw that and just basically said, "I've got to have it." And so it took 5,000 man hours, and Kenmore Aviation rebuilt it. Obviously, they've been running their airline with Beavers and piston and turbine Beavers for the last 75 years or something crazy. And they have some of the best pilots in the world. And their maintenance facility, their refurb facility, their logistics—they're flying literally these from mine's from 1957. They're flying an airline, selling seats. It's just incredible what they do there. So, I was able to fly to work. So I had it in front of my house, and I would fly it into work quite a bit. If you look in that right seat right there, that's Sean D. Tucker. That was my first Oshkosh, and we did a photo flight, and I took up a little girl and Jesse Panzer's extra. So that was also. And that was 2 days before training camp started. So, yeah, that was also a wild one.
And you don't just take it on the water. You've got everything for this bird.
So I think right now I'm the only one in the Continental 50 that has all three setups. So I have the wheels, I have the ski gear, retractable ski gear, and I have the amphib. And those ski gear right there, they're highly sought after. I've had probably 50 calls about those ski gears, but yeah, that was me on a Porsche car rally that I put together with Kelly Moss, and I brought in the beaver, and that's actually a frozen lake. That's a frozen lake right there. So that was pretty cool. Pretty cool. But it was freezing that day. I think it was like -9 with the wind chill or something. It didn't want to start. I mean, like, because it's always in a hangar, you know, it's taken care of like ridiculously. But, you know, it ended up getting so cold when I went to start, and just that noise was just so painful for me. And so I'll always bring a heater from now on if I ever do that again.
That's amazing. Now you've always talked about seaplane flying being one of kind of the highest skill levels of aviation. You've got tailwheel, of course, which is really important, but tell me a little bit about your views on that.
Yeah, I mean, I see seaplane and helicopter on the same level as far as skill level goes. You know, just from all the seaplane flying that I was doing, it really helped me with helicopters because of your ability to understand wind. You know, you're always landing off airport, so every decision is made by the pilot. You know, normally, you know, when you get to destination, either you're gonna call into the tower, or you're gonna just communicate and do position reports. And with this, there's no one you're talking to. You're in British Columbia. You're about to land in a mountain lake that has one way in, one way out, and surrounded by you know, there's probably where the lake is probably another 3,000 feet of elevation. That's just straight up a mountain. So you're hugging a mountain, splashing into this pond, you know, this little lake. And so to be able to do that, you really have to understand where the winds are coming from. You have to land into the wind. And that's equal to a helicopter. That's where a lot of people get in trouble, is some type of downwind landing. When you do that, you're going to have something called descending with power, and there's no way out of it for the most part, except just forward, airspeed. But, you know, and that's how a lot of people wreck. Or, you know, you have a wind that's going into your tail rotor thrust, which is going to be a loss of tail rotor authority, and that's going to put you into oscillation and spin that you can't get out of. So there's very many aspects of wind that you really truly have to understand with helicopters, and similar with seaplanes. And then with a seaplane too, you have this big old plane with huge wings, and you're coming into docks. Well, there's no reverse. There's an engine rolling. So, you know, at some point you have to make a decision based on how quickly you're going to that dock, make sure there's no pylons or anything else, and you're going to cut the engine off, let it coast, jump out and grab the wing. You know, so it's like, you know, it's like the raw form of aviation. It's absolutely beautiful. It puts so much responsibility on the pilot. So your base knowledge has to be very, you know, just very experienced in those situations. And I was blessed enough to have one of the best seaplane pilots that ever lived. And his name's Bill. He's out of Seattle. He still flies for Kenmore. He flies one of their twin otters now, their turbine otters. And he started with bush flying and seaplane flying. Then he was in the Navy. He landed on carriers. And then he's a retired 777 Alaska pilot. And he's worked for Kenmore his entire career. And he also ran beavers and turbines out of Alaska. So he's the only one, literally, when I did, like, the first time I ever landed on snow or with skis, the only human being I'd ever met that had done it in a beaver was Bill. So Bill flew in, and he's teaching me everything in this like 48-hour crash course of what you want to look out for. The way you want to land is a little different than the water when it comes to wind. There's wind drifts. There's all kinds of stuff when you're landing on a frozen lake. But you know, he just incredible knowledge. So I truly have been blessed to learn so much from so many people.
That is so amazing. And you know, it's interesting because in general aviation, I think manufacturers have looked at that market, that idea of kind of like be on a lake, go out, get out there. And we've seen aircraft, especially in the experimental world, but also in some other areas, where it's marketed in a way that seems like it's hey, just get out there and have fun. But it's such a different level of flying, as you mentioned. I mean, I even saw it at Oshkosh going down the seaplane base with heavy winds. The people that can do that are so impressive. What are your thoughts on how you reconcile, on one hand, looking at this as such a high level skill, and on the other hand, the desire of the industry sometimes to make it look like, hey, just get a seaplane like a boat,
or like a jet ski? And
yes.
Yeah, it's just not like that. I mean, there's so much drag on the aircraft that you're not going to have the ability to climb, right? And so you're lucky if you live in Miami or you live somewhere in the South, because you don't have to deal with mountains even, right? You're not dealing with high altitude. I mean, I flew the Beaver across the country. I mean, I've flown across the country probably 8-9 times, going 90 miles per hour. When you're flying that through the mountain passes, you know, you're hugging the leeward side of where the wind's coming from. You know, when you take off from those runways, you need 20 miles to climb. I mean, it just doesn't want to climb, especially with those big amphibs. So I would say that it's one of the things where I think a lot of companies and a lot of manufacturers, and just people in general, they like to rely on so much technology, right? But there's no technology that is going to always tell you which way to land. You know, there's no technology that's going to tell you don't land in that canyon because you'll never be able to climb and take off. There's so many places you can land, but you can't take off because you need to get over that tree line. You need to get over that hill, and it's just not going to be able to do it because of the drag. It just needs more space. It needs more run for takeoff. I think that sometimes is kind of the issue is, you know, a lot of people want to always base everything off technology. And it's happened, you know, it even happens now where there's a lot of people, you know, and there's many aircrafts that have parachutes now, which is incredible, and it has saved lives, and it's awesome. But as a pilot, you need to make sure you understand everything, and you need to make sure that every emergency you're just not thinking parachute, right? Really understand what's going on and figure it out, because the majority of accidents are on takeoff and landing, and you're too low to pull that parachute anyways.
Right.
So that parachute can help you. So right. If you really need to understand glide ratio, you know, you really need to understand, probably not going to be doing a 180 off a takeoff, right? Which is where a lot of pilots get in trouble. So I would say that technology is unbelievable, and it's helped us in so many ways, right? GPS is amazing. Direct to, who doesn't love that? What Bose and what Garmin, what all these companies are doing is just incredible. But yet, you as a pilot, you are PIC, and your knowledge base needs to go far beyond that. And you need to make sure that you're always not relying on straight technology, because technology does fail. You do have alternative failures. You know, if you have an alternative failure in a Bonanza, in a Beaver, and you have a G1000, that thing's not going to last. That battery's not going to last. There's too much juice, you know, so all that technology that you're relying on, and to understand where you are in the sky, now you're outside looking down, and you gotta make sure you understand how to do that, you know, or you're gonna have a problem. I think that's where, you know, there's just needs to be more stress on it of like, yes, technology is good, but you know, I implore a lot of people to, you know, train and learn off of technology first. Cause then after that, and you transition to it, it's like, oh, this is so much easier, you know, so much easier.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And it's also a really good segue, because I want to make sure that we have time to talk about the Huey a little bit. And I have always, you know, been told by some of the best helicopter pilots that have been on the show and things like that, that helicopter flying is like wearing it. It is different than any other kind of flying. Tell me, is that true? Tell me your perspective on all that.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You know, I remember when I learned how to fly, I made sure that I was switching between the helicopter and the aerobatic plane, mainly because of the difference in the movement of your feet and controls. If there is any change in power whatsoever, up or down, with the collective, there has to be a change in your feet and the cyclic. That's because everything's connected. So if you pull in power, that's going to cause torque, right? So your pedals are technically anti-torque. That blade that's moving back in the back, that is what's stopping you from rotating counter, the opposite of the blade, of the way the blade goes. So because of that, every little thing you do is going to have a little movement. Now, when you're going to land on a dolly, or you're going to go land on a pinnacle approach on the top of a building, now that gets even crazier, because you can get so tight and focused, you can start these oscillations, right? So you're trying to counter the movement of this thing. You know, maybe there's wind coming, you know, there's this thing called transitional lift. You know, there's so many little physics that are going on because of what's happening above you, that you have to be in, you have to be so in tune with the aircraft. And truly, I think that, you know, most helicopter pilots know so much more about the aircraft than a lot of fixed wing pilots, because you have to. There's just so many more moving parts that are critical. You know, like when, like as a pilot, when you go around, there's obviously your pre-flight. You know, as a helicopter pilot, you're opening up panels. You know, you're getting screwdrivers and opening up every panel in that helicopter for you takeoff. At least I am. You know, we check everything. We check torque stripe. We have torque stripe on everything. And if there's any movement within that, that helicopter's grounded. You know, for every hour that my helicopter flies, it goes through 2 hours of maintenance. My head of maintenance, Christian, incredible human being. What's up, brother? You know, he's been a part of this venture from day one. You know, when I got the idea through a good friend of mine, Rick, you know, he was the first person to ask. I said, hey, you want to be a part of this? Because, you know, maintenance is the number one most important thing with being a pilot. You know, that's something you can't skimp on. You know, that's something that you can't bypass, especially when you're like myself and you're carrying a lot of precious cargo, a lot of kids, a lot of veterans, and a bunch of celebrities. You know, you got to make sure that everything's good. And then me, I love my life as well. but yeah, I mean, I would say helicopter, it was definitely hard to transition. You know, I think it's harder to go from planes to helicopters than helicopters to planes. I still think the learning curve also is kind of difficult from helicopters to plane, because the IFR, not like, you know, I have my IFR in a helicopter, but you're not flying IFR in helicopters unless you're working a dual operation out of Alaska somewhere. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, that is really amazing. Have you ever considered merging the aerobatic interests and the helicopter side? I mean, we've had Chuck Aaron on the show here, Aaron Fitzgerald, are going, you know, both these guys flip these things around. What is your, what are your thoughts on that? You ever fly one of those rigid?
I flew a Fitzgerald, incredible, crazy sound. I mean, you know, what that rotor head does, it's a fully titanium rotor head. It's just incredible. It's just an absolute feat of engineering. And the maneuverability of the helicopter. actually, that was a helicopter that we were looking into instead of the Huey, because I already had my eye on something like that. It's called a BO-105, and it's hard to get parts for it, so we had to part ways with that. Huey parts are abundant, so. But yeah, it's an incredible helicopter. It's the craziest sound you ever hear, is when you're sitting there and you're just sitting in a hover. And he's like, all right, let's go. And we just do a back tuck in a helicopter. It's just so wild. So wild.
That's absolutely fantastic. Well, I want to make sure also that we get time towards the end for, you know, what you're doing now. Because you do so many things. You've talked about it a little bit. You alluded to the flights that you do with the Huey. You've got a foundation. You give so much back, including spending time with us here tonight. Tell me a little bit about where your heart is on this, and you know, what you're doing, how other people can help.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when I was younger, you know, this honestly, really, if you think about it, started back when I was 11. You know, I was in this home, and you know, these guys came by for Christmas, dropped off presents, did a whole thing, and then I remember the next day, it was in the newspaper front page. But I also remember that no one spoke one word to me. And that had an impact on me, you know, and I was like, well, what was that really about? And so I always said, you know, if I ever do anything for anybody, I want it to be for the right reasons and the right purpose. And so, you know, from day one, starting the foundation, you know, I knew, you know, obviously wanted to help, veterans, but really wanted to lean in, on kids and, you know, make sure that we expose them, to new opportunities. You know, that's kind of the main thing. And one of the reasons why, you know, EA Young Eagles was so big for me, was, you know, really, I love to introduce underprivileged or kids owned by the state into aviation. I really push kids into the aerospace technology industry, and I try to implore them into the job opportunities that are there. You know, a pilot, engineer, mechanic, there's so many opportunities. And within those opportunities, if you're underprivileged, there are a ton of programs that help. EA has a bunch, AOPA has a bunch. Even Delta has a program where you can, it's on job work training for 2 years, and I think you have a little contract with them afterwards, but you're getting paid the entire time. And then I also, push kids into going to tech school, because, for a lot of them, a 4-year college and incurring massive amounts of debt is just impossible. So I usually like to push them into that. And, it's really a passion that I have, because I think that, I went through a lot of things for a reason. I think that the reason I went through all those things, that at such a young age, was so I, because one day I would have a platform, and one day I would have the ability to affect lives. And, we still keep in touch with a ton of the kids that we've flown. And, one of them's in West Point. He just got accepted into their flight program. Another one I sent off, he's deployed. He's flying Blackhawks. So I got to fly him 2 days before he left. And he was a completely different human being from before the first, from the first time I met him. I probably met him 3 or 4 years before that, he's just a young kid, just a young teenager. And when I sent him off on his first deployment to do medevac, he was a grown man, very respectful, just had so much focus in his life. He said he wanted to fly for the 160th one day. So, he had, aviation, had really changed him. And so that's really what I look to do, is just try to impact as many lives as I can. I went and spoke, so my foundation, we're also part of what's going on next year, which is called the Arctic Challenge 2025. And it's where myself, one of my best friends, he's a former Navy SEAL, and a couple out of New Orleans, Hannah and her husband, we're all meeting up this weekend. Actually, it's a big training camp for us in New Orleans, 4 or 5 days with our coaches flying in from Europe. But we will all be rowing across the Arctic Ocean next July to chase a few world records and to raise money for a few nonprofits in New Orleans. One of them being the Covenant House, which is a homeless shelter for teenagers, and to transition them into adulthood. And, I couldn't ask for a better opportunity. And, 4 months ago, when I sat in front of them and was able to talk and give them a speech, and, I'm pretty raw about it, especially the older kids, and kind of how I talk. It's in my aspect, I just let them know that first off, no matter what happens for the rest of your life, you have almost like a superpower, where you went through so much so young that there's nothing in adulthood that will ever scare you, right? Like most people, when they go through hard times, it's usually 30s and 40s when they really, something happens, money or job or family. I said, but you've been through all of these things before you're 18. I said, when you're 18, when you go through anything, hard times, when you have to work hard for a job, you're going to run right over that. That's going to be nothing compared to what you've been through when you were a helpless child. For me, I sit here and I think, when I sat in the same circumstance, I wish I had somebody rowing for me, somebody who believed in me, was trying to give me better opportunities, was trying to raise money, so that someone could come in and teach me and give me better job opportunities, and I could be linked with the New Orleans Saints and Tulane University. It's incredible work. It's obviously an incredible challenge, the kind of what we have ahead of us. Mm-hmm. The training is absolutely brutal. My hands are just absolutely destroyed.
Yeah. I can only imagine. That's got to be unbelievable. Well, we'll certainly keep track of that. One, do you have any advice for everyone watching, for people out there in general aviation who want to give back in these ways, how we can connect past just the local community that might be, you're expanding aviation through a lot of these programs, but you're expanding it to middle-class families that are bringing their kids because everything's great. But how do we get to that next level? How do we get to expose kids to aviation in all its different ways and show them what they can do for the ones that were like in your situation, for the ones that don't get brought by a happy family to the gate of the airport?
You know, this is something that we do here locally in Miami, and I've done in the other places that I've played is I have routed a lot of what I do through Young Eagles. And, you know, what I love doing is pairing with either a local high school, local middle school, you know, with some type of facility. And then I get them invited to the airport. So they get brought there by the facility, by the high school and their buses. It's like almost like a little field trip for them. And then they'll come to the hangar. And when they come to the hangar, you know, I'll have parts and pieces. I'll have a mechanic there. You know, I have a Boston Dynamics robot, so I can get the kids to play with the robot and teach them about robotics. And then I go through and we walk on the helicopter and I start to talk about various things. And then we look at the parts and my mechanic talks about his job and what he did through aviation. And then I start to talk to them about the incredible opportunities within aviation. And even if you are, if you want to get into it and you know, you don't think that maybe going to tech school or going to college is for you, well, then join the military. And surely you will get it through that. You're going to get disciplined. You're going to travel the world most likely, and you're going to be working on or flying some of the greatest aircrafts to ever enter the sky. And so, you know, that's what I do is I like to use the program to really bring these kids in and really just expose them to that light. And, you know, I think that's something where a lot of people, you know, kind of, you know, just have to really just implore that, because there's so many underprivileged kids or kids that just haven't been exposed to that, have no idea that it even exists. Like what Shondi Tucker is doing out there on the West Coast with the Bob Hoover Academy. I mean, I would implore people to really look into that and what he's doing and the lives that he's changing. These kids get a full scholarship. They get plucked out of high school. They go through a 4-year program in high school, and by the end of it, they're going to have their pilot's license, or they're going to have or their mechanic's license. There's also another school that is, it's right there where Sun and Fun is. I'm going to go back this year again to Sun and Fun, and I'm going to link is specifically with them. I got to fly some of the kids that go to this high school, but they also have a program there, and it's a 4-year high school program, and all these kids are on scholarship. All those kids get their pilot's license by the time they graduate. Wow. And it's a full ride. And they're all being plucked from those little farm communities all around. So, you know, there's so many bases and opportunities that I know the government will support if you try to do something grandiose like that. But yet, it's just as simple as having a day or Young Eagles Day at your hangar or local airport, and you just pair yourself. Where there's always a chaperone, that, you know, they're brought, and there's this whole event where, you know, out of 10 to 20 kids, just changing one life is enough.
Right.
And so for me, you know, that's what's been so special about that program, and, you know, linking it, you know, with my foundation, it's just the opportunity to just share so much and to expose these kids to just this why, even if it's one, you know, it's worth it.
It's so fantastic, and I'm so grateful for all the work that you do, and you really set a model for everyone. And again, anyone can, you know, if you're having a Young Eagles event, or you know that, or you just want to open up your hangar, you, as you mentioned, you can reach out and call an organization that serves an underprivileged community and just invite them. Let them handle the organization and everything, but do some outreach, I guess, can really do, everybody can do a little bit to follow in your footsteps. And it's just really wonderful. My hat's off to you for doing that.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, we all could do it, right? It's like literally just call. I mean, there's a homeless shelter in every city. Call them up and be like, I'd love to get involved. I'd love to expose kids to aviation.
Yeah.
Call up a local middle school, high school, and talk about, you know, I'd love to donate and to start something. You know, obviously there's parent permission, all these things that go on, but you can gift a kid who, a kid who academically is very inclined, you know, and there's all these programs, you know, there's something that we just did, a big foundation thing at Tamiami, for an autistic school, and, you know, all those kids, you know, we flew the helicopter and they're all climbing around the helicopter, just these big smiles with their families. It's things that, you know, out of all the things that I've ever done, you know, racing in Cambodia or you know, scoring in the NFL. When a little kid is placed into the Huey, you know, and they just have this big smile, this big grandiose smile, and you do something right.
Yeah, and they will remember that for the rest of their lives. Well, Jimmy, we've reached a time of the hour where just before we wrap up, we do something called Social Flight's Fast Five. Are you up for that? Ask you a few questions?
Yeah, sure.
All right, Jimmy Graham, this is your Social Flight Fast Five. Five questions just to get people to know a little bit more about who Jimmy Graham, the NFL legend and pilot, is. And I'm going to start with a question number one. You have done so many different types of flying, like we mentioned, you know, aerobatic, seaplane, in the flight levels, helicopters, you name it, and a whole lot of different aircraft. What out of all that, if you just had to pick the first thing that came to mind, the first plane out of anything you've ever flown or aircraft of any kind you've ever flown, what would it be? What's your favorite?
Ooh, ever flown or owned? Just flown?
Oh, no, just been in. You don't have to have owned it.
I would say last year, the F-16 with the with our famed Makos down here at the Homestead Air Force Base. You know, to fly an F-16, to fly with one of my boys and you know, all those guys down at Homestead, you know, all the stuff that they do and, you know, all the stuff they've done over the years was just probably one of the greatest moments of my life.
That is so cool. That I did not expect that one out of everything you've flown. That is very, very cool. All right, cool. Question number two. When you think back again, you've been flying for a really long time, but also there have been a number of things in your life, even outside of aviation, maybe in sports or the rest. Was there some moment, something that's been either a very scary moment or impactful moment or something that you believe you really learned something dramatic from?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so many moments. I've had so many moments. Here's one. When I remember, going up in the extra, I had somebody in there. And, you know, at the time I'm doing tail slides for quite a while. You know, we're going backwards for a bit. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm looking out over the left and then all of a sudden everything goes quiet. And I'm like, oh. And I look up and the engine's not going. And instead of freaking out, pulling the canopy and pulling my parachute or, you know, messing around with anything, I do understand, well, if I get wind back over these blades and I keep the mags, I'm most likely it'll start up again, which it did. And we found and we went back to the airport. But, you know, I think, you know, it's those wild moments that you get where things hit you unexpectedly and you're able to process, evaluate, and make the right decision. And that was one of those moments for me, especially because I had somebody on board. But I called Doug Beatty up actually, and I told him what happened. And you know, he just told me, "Congratulations, I'm fine. I'm finally an aerobatic pilot." And so we bumped up the idle because I guess I was tail sliding for like 1,500 feet or something. So, yeah.
That might do it. Okay. Question number three: If you could go back to any moment in your life that you can think of, not to change anything or make a different decision, but just because it was so special that if you could go back and re-experience it for, you know, 15 minutes or so, what's some moment in your life that you wish you could teleport back to and re-experience?
Wow. I would honestly say the first time I ever scored in the Superdome. Once I was drafted, I mean, really nobody thought anything would actually happen. I mean, except maybe Sean and Mickey, and Drew, but you know, I wasn't a football player. And so to go in there and to score my first touchdown in the dome and to hear this place just erupt, you know, you never get bored of that. You never get tired of it. It is one of the greatest moments of my life. And, you know, I was obsessed with chasing it. That's why I had 90 of them.
Okay. Question number four, if you could go back in time, teens or 20s or something back then, and give a piece of advice to your younger self, what is it that you might tell yourself back then?
My younger self. Oh man, I don't even know. My younger self.
Maybe you're not old enough yet for that.
No, I've no, definitely. Oh my goodness. Well, I went into college with some very grandiose ideas. So, my first two years of college, I was a chemistry major. So I'll tell myself not to be a chemistry major, just go straight to business. That was the most studying I had ever done in my entire life. I mean, I had no life. I was just in the study hall. I was just in labs. It was absolutely terrible. So I would definitely tell myself, just go straight to business.
I love that. Go straight to business, and you might have been good at a few hundred other things as well. So we're good with that. All right, our last question on Social Place Fast Five. Question number five: if you could choose anyone, alive, dead, current, history, anyone at all, to spend an evening with, is there someone that comes to mind?
If I could, well, there's two people. So I'm gonna have to choose two. Tammy Myerson, she was my mentor through my career. She passed away 9 years ago. She was instrumental with teaching me business and life. And she was also the one who introduced me to aviation. All of her brothers and all of her sisters are all pilots, all six. I would say the late Joe Clark. I met him in Seattle, and he was an incredible man. And we had so many conversations about aviation. He had a true pass for aviation. Obviously, he had the Clay Lacy Learjet. He would send me videos of him rolling a Lear. And he's the reason why I have a Turbo Commander. I remember it's probably 7 years ago. He texted me, "You're a Turbo Commander pilot." And he sent me the plane. I said, "That's an ugly plane." I was like, "There's no way." And then when I went to go look for a turbine, I was looking at everything, Cheyenne, this and that. And then finally I said, "Okay, let me look at the numbers on this thing." And then I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. So I tried to match it up as best I can, but we couldn't figure it out because he had a special paint scheme. But he had a Gulfstream painted just like that. And that's the reason I painted that way. So he was an incredible human being, and I'm just very grateful for the times and the conversations and the dinners that I had with him while I was in Seattle. Obviously he changed aviation, with winglets, and what he did for airlines and for Gulfstreams and for everybody was just incredible. And he was an even more incredible human being.
That is so wonderful. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening, especially so exhausted as you must be coming back from the Gumball 3000 race. I am so grateful for you spending time, for your friendship, and for everything that you do for general aviation and for young people and veterans all around the country. So thanks for taking the time to join us here in Social Flight Live.
I appreciate you having me. I hope everybody had a good time. And let's do this again next year after I row across the Arctic. I'm sure I'll have some interesting stories for you.
You beat me to asking you to come back, my friend. That is, I would love that.
So,
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah, we'll follow you on that. Have a wonderful, wonderful evening.
thank you guys. I'll see you.
Take care. And thanks to all of you for taking time to join us here on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday at 8 p.m. with our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff and I. We're going to talk about trust. This is really important with a new FAA ruling that's come down, with some of Brian's experiences that he has had with air traffic control, some other stuff. It's going to be a very, very interesting show. And if you want to register for that, go to cockpit2cowl.com. Use the number two, cockpit2cowl, just one straight thing.com. You can register for that show. And then we're back here on Social Flight Live on Tuesday, October 15th, with JJ Frege of Hartzell Propeller. We are going to learn all about what's going on there. They are a fantastic company. Everything there is built on honor. That's their logo, that's their phrase, and that is the truth about that company. So, cannot wait to see you there for that show. Until next time, thank you so much for everything that you do for general aviation and for joining us here on Social Flight Live. And I wish you all blue skies.